Welcome to the Open Book Podcast. What you're about to hear is a recording of a live event that took place at the September 2025 edition of the Open Book Festival. In this event called Facing Death, Foloso Agbaje, Remy Ngamije, and Sarah Ojeda speak to Erin Bates about journeying with grief. Here's their conversation.
All right, the elevator music has been very gingerly wound down. Welcome, welcome everyone. And thank you for joining us to face death on your Sunday morning at the beginning of spring. We're going to start a little unconventionally before we do introductions and get into the swing of things. So I'm going to invite us all to take a minute's silence, like a vigil, and invite everyone here to think about what death, what journeying with grief you may be bringing with us into this conversation. So for a minute, sit in your chair, feel the firm ground of this beautiful and complicated place called District 6 that is so precious to our city. Stir to you, get into some belly breaths, and let's give it a minute's silence. Okay, that's a minute. Mm-hmm. A minute vigil. Possibly a first at the Open Book Festival. So, I'm happy to introduce our three panelists this afternoon. On my left is Foloso.
Yes.
There we go. Agbaje. And then Sarah Ojeda. And then Remy Ngamije.
Yeah.
They are going to do something also unconventional, which is introduce one another by reading from the author's description in each of the books. So let's start with you, Foloso.
Okay, so I've got Sarah Ojeda's book, which is called Not This Tender. And Sarah's introduction goes as follows. Sarah Ojeda is a Libyan-born poet and essayist living and working in Cape Town. She holds a BA honors degree in English literature and a Master's of Arts in English Studies, specializing in poetry, from Stellenbosch University, both with distinction. Her MA was funded following the award of a Margaret McNamara Education Grant. In 2021, Sarah was the recipient of the internationally renowned Miles Moreland Foundation Writing Scholarship. She is also the recipient of the 2020 Dan Veitch Prize for Young Poets, which invites poetry from college-age students across the United States and internationally. Sarah's poetry and lyric essays have been widely published, both locally and abroad, in anthologies like We Call to the Eye and the Night by Persia Books and Relations, an anthology of African and diaspora voices by HarperCollins, and in journals like New Contrast, Atlanta Review, The Other Side of Hope, The Shore, Fresh.inc, Plume, and Everyday Fiction. She is a regular contributor at poetry reading groups such as Off the Wall and The Red Wheelbarrow. Not This Tender is her debut collection.
Very impressive.
I will read for
Folusho. Folusho Agbaje has been writing stories since she first learned to write. She loves London but calls Lagos home, and her stories are shaped by these two cities that have captured her heart. When not curled up with her Kindle and a pack of chocolate biscuits, you'll likely find in a bookshop, museum, or restaurant. She's a big fan of period dramas and has watched every episode of Downton Abbey more times than she's willing to admit. She also believes that there's no need to make a new remake of Pride and Prejudice because
that is not in my
the
mind.
Emma Thompson one. The like, Emma Thompson one was perfect. She enjoys singing in a church choir, walking, and swimming. After graduating from the Faber Academy in 2022, Folusho completed debut novel, The Parlor Wife. She has a master's degree in management and human resources from the London School of Economics and a bachelor's degree in accounting from Loughborough University. She lives in Lagos with her husband and two children, balancing her passion for writing with a full-time career in financial services and ensuring that there's no other Emma Thompson remake.
Okay, this is also not my bad. A very embellished bio. Thank you, Remy.
Excellent. Okay, I'm going to do Remy, writer of Only Stars Know the Meaning of Space. Okay. Remy Ngamija is a Rwandan-born Namibian writer and photographer. He won the Africa Regional Prize of the 2021 Commonwealth Short Story Prize and was shortlisted for the Kane Prize for African Writing in 2021 and 2020. He is the founder of the Duk Arts Trust, an arts organization which publishes Duk, okay, the country's first literary magazine, which he co-founded. I should have read it before, and I always do this. And serves as editor-in-chief. His work has been supported by the Civitella Rineri Foundation and the Miles Morland Foundation, and has been featured in literary festivals in Accra, Cape Town, Johannesburg, Nairobi, Berlin, and Basel. More of his writing can be read on his website, remythequill.com.
Act fast. Okay, well, thanks for taking that burden off my shoulders. I left my reading copies at home, so I'm feeling very unsupported by my books, but I'm supported by my panelists. So I'm Erin Bates. I'm a broadcast journalist. I work for Carte Blanche, but that's not really that important for the Open Book Festival. More importantly, I'm a lapsed bookseller and wannabe writer, and did a full 6 months of working behind the counter at the Book Lounge, which is behind this amazing festival. So I've actually got a small offering as we take this journey of grief facing and looking at death. Gather now. Death, they say, like taxes, is inevitable. And so we gather here today to face it head on. Join this caravan journeying with grief. Our shepherds, three scribes, two penners, and a poet. And so we best begin. The living come to reckon with what's dead and gone. So on that note, I'd like to invite Sarah to please read The Forethought of Grief, one of the poems in her collection.
Okay, thank you. So this this poem actually specifically came about when I was obsessed. Well, first of all, I found out that the sun is going to implode eventually. When I was 2 years ago, that was the first time, and I was so upset that no one's bothered to tell me, firstly. And so I was thinking a lot about, I went to a writer's retreat where we had an astronomer as well, and we talked about what the hell is going on in the universe. And then, yeah, so I was thinking a lot about endings and, forethought of grief, you know, because like you said, it's inevitable. And it was, this poem was also inspired by a line from a poem I loved, can't remember the title or the writer, but the line is, I come into the peace of wild things who do not tax themselves, their lives, with forethought of grief.
Wow.
Yeah, tax, yeah. Different meaning, but yeah. All right, here we go. Can you guys hear me, by the way?
Yeah, yeah.
I feel like this chair is... Okay. forgive this perfect day. Its skies blued, bruising earth's clavicle. First, there was dust and dirt, and now, field. The warm green pulse on the wrist of everything. Grasslands of gasps gathered and hidden from ourselves, always dying to save something for later. Extinction soaks my sleeve. I do not trade time for air, living each hour till living hurts. In the kitchen, peeling pomegranates, hoping hunger can teach me something for getting straight away. Giving way in your eyes are days, days, days. Pour them like paint over poems you have no home for, or bury them like fresh prey under the weight of tomorrow's hunt.
Lovely. Beautiful. Lovely, lovely.
Remy, at the very onset of your wonderfully creative book, which is a mixtape meets a kind of topographical, typographical mishmash. There's a missive to the reader. Would you share it with us, please?
So it says, for readers, both met and unmet, taking the long way round, searching over, under, around, and through, and finding the hope, hold the light, the prayer, hold the light, the anthem, help is on the way.
We have to clap as well.
Of course. Okay. Okay, so where do we go from here? Facing death. I mean, it's quite a gig, right? I don't know how far we're going to get in an hour or just under it now. But in terms of your book, Fulusho, beg your pardon, you deal at a point, or your protagonist deals with the death of a parent. It comes up in all of the books, loss, the loss of a parent. Maybe it came up for some of you in that minute's meditation. And I'd love for you to read, if you can. I see signs of it on page 45.
Okay.
But wherever you please, I know you earmarked something to read.
Okay, so I will apologize in advance that this place that Erin has marked is a spoiler in the book, so anybody who's not read it, sorry, in advance. So I'll start from page 44 to kind of flow into the part of page 45. Kende had once read that bad news traveled fast, and she remembered the saying now as she made her way through their crowded palo with a tray of water in her hands. Somehow, everyone in the surrounding streets had heard that her father was missing and presumed dead. The same visitors that had celebrated with them just 2 days ago were now bringing their condolences in the form of words, dishes full of ikokore, ewa, and asaro, and barely concealed pity in their eyes. Kende's mother looked like she had aged 10 years overnight. Lines were etched across the previously smooth skin on her face, the brightness in her gaze replaced by a dull glint. She wore a brown iruamboba, and her hair was tied up in a black headscarf, looking like a broken doll that had been put together by a blind man. She sat on the sofa in the parlor, propped up by Uncle Ladipo and Auntie Laide, unable to acknowledge the visitors who were speaking about how great a man Baba Ebeji had been, how tragic the accident was, how he would be missed. Kende handed out glasses of water, more out of a sense of obligation than an actual desire to care for the people who had shown up uninvited to their home. She wanted to curl up in her father's boot and pretend they were playing a game of hide and seek, the way they used to when she and Taiwo were little. As she made her way through the parlor, there were murmured apologies and sighs of thanks. What a brave girl you are. Your father would be so proud of you. God have mercy on you. You and Taiwo need to be strong for your mother. The last comment came from Mrs. Fari, a trader from the stall a few doors down from theirs in the market. I was barely your age when my own father passed away, she continued, adjusting the waistline of her iro, where Kende had collected the bag of stewing beef she had brought. I had to fend for my three younger sisters and my mother, but God was faithful. He will provide for you in your time of need. Kende looked at her blankly. Where was God now? Her father had attended Bethel Cathedral every Sunday, singing and clapping during the praise and worship. Every time she knelt to pray, it was because her father was constantly reminding her that God wanted to hear from her too. He knew the Bible from beginning to end. He could recite the book of Proverbs in Yoruba, but he had not been among the survivors. As he giveth, so he taketh, Kende heard her father's voice say in her mind, and she shook her head against the words. Why had God taken her father? What had they done to deserve this? God had failed him when he needed God most. God's plan, she heard her father's voice again. Did God plan for them to be found wanting when they were most in need? Did God plan for the inevitability of death to continue to break the humans he cared so much for? The worst part was Kende kept trying to imagine her father's final moment. Drowning was supposed to be excruciatingly painful, but he couldn't have drowned. She was convinced he had been hurt. Maybe something had hit him on the head, and it had been an instant blackout with no pain. Or could he have been trapped somewhere underwater, screaming silently, unable to swim out? This particular line of thinking was sending Kende down a tunnel she was sure would end in insanity.
So is the message of that excerpt that if we face death and try to really answer the question of what it is, we're going down a road of insanity?
Yep.
So this whole panel discussion is a journey down the road of insanity. So Remy, you, in your book, which is a collection of kind of shorter form fiction, have a story or a text that deals with kind of collective grief, right? And it deals with the facing of death that the living must do. And it begins with the beautiful word, ukutula.
Would you
please read some
for us? So this comes from the short story called Seven Silences of the Heart. And it follows the structure of that very, very magical South African song called Ukutula. And I'm reading from a little bit from the first. Number one, Ukutula. Your family sent for kin as best as they could. Many relatives didn't have enough money to make a living, let alone travel to honor the dead. Still, enough people arrived to fill the house with their jarring dialects and stories of the place you barely know as home. Your father translated their gentle messages for sympathy for you. Since they spoke too fast and peppered their conversation with idioms you couldn't understand. We came to bury your mother, our sister, they said. We came to help you weep. We came to break apart and put ourselves together. Your native language had been on its way out for years. You did your best to reply. All you could do was say, thank you for coming all this way. They looked affronted. You were speaking from the grammar and politeness of English classes, from a learned reservation they did not understand. They were speaking from their hearts, from culture, from a tradition alien to you in diaspora. Distance means nothing in death, they said. Not here, not on the moon. We came to show you how not to be alone. When you cried, they understood. Grief was a new tongue you needed to learn. Come, they said, we will teach you. Uncles and aunts assumed their cultural roles and made their requisite preparations, always consulting with you as your father's spokesperson, his firstborn.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Can you read that line again about grief as a tongue?
It says, here we go. It said, when you cried, they understood. Grief was a new tongue you needed to learn.
What's beautiful about that is it speaks to some of the poems in Sarah's collection, because you talk about language and the grief of a tongue not known. Do you want to read another poem for us?
Yes. Shall we do the
whichever you like?
Holiday? All right. Yeah, Remy, I resonated with so many of the lines you were saying. Yeah. Even the learned reservation of English? Was it learned? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you don't know what the hell to say, so you're like, thanks for coming. Yeah. Wow. Okay. All right. This is probably the most difficult poem. It was the most difficult poem to write. It took me years, and it looked very different at different times. And it's called Russian Holiday, or a Russian Holiday Part 2, and there's Part 1 earlier in the book, but I will let you guys enjoy it when you buy the book, you will read it. All right. A Russian Holiday Part 2. You barged in with a glass of orange juice early, time still on your side, scanning the room for my sobs. The forgive me you were sure had to be there somewhere. I did not lie. You didn't know what to do with all your motherly mercy bundled on your lap like clean clothes. I didn't ask you to scrub the cold red clots or change the sheets so we forget. I just sat combing my hair. But you had to dig me up, brushed brittle strands, stuck to stubborn knot behind my ear. The body was splinter, my body was splinter, and your kindness broke my spine. The small animal I was, I would have given up anything, the poetry, the smoking, the mourning, just to tell you something died here. But you pulled my hair so bloody hard, I learned silence is absolution, and confessing was just a selfish daughter begging for the love she fucked away. You yanked the hair you'd spent all morning unknotting, had a way of making any ache feel well-deserved, and I understood. A mother can always tell the innocence of a skinned knee from a suffering summoned, knows blood from wound, from birth, from love. But a daughter scavengers, digs it all up, red and cruel and split end, all in the name of this little poem. She is me, and I ruin the image of you, pained, pale, on that plastic chair. The night you labored alone, body battling birth and death. 4 rounds of anesthesia and only one daughter to show for it. Hair, blood, wet, thinning before your eyes. You struck me, screeched. I don't want to see your face right now. You howled and heaved. But all your howls taught me was that a daughter shall hoard everything. Memory, mistake, miracle, and word. This is how we heal our mothers. You gutted lamb, unthreadable, as I stood intact and smiling, till my lip split. And for just a second in that ugly hospital room, all pain belonged to you. They said the fetus was too small to bury, but they never let you see how small. I was never going to tell you something died here. Mother, years ago, when the nurses sent you home, empty-handed, uterus no longer womb, in the car you asked, almost forgiven, when can we visit the grave? He switched off the engine, said nothing. In his cold carcass car, we could have given up anything, anyone, for a word from him. But silence folded you into his back seat, precise as a needle. You stuffed your body into the silhouette of the driver's seat. This is the first time you disappear. Beside you, the can of baby blue paint you'll eventually give away. And Daddy, not looking at me, is how I teach myself to replace you. Our tint family felt lighter now, 2 kilograms apart, your face a little thinner, his 10 years older, nothing left to want. Two cigarettes later, he said, "No, we can't visit. We won't find the gravestone. The coffin's empty," he added. "And while you lay losing his son, his scar was broken into, the baby bag is gone. And anyway," he sang, "like everything was sun, why cut through snow and sinew when you can sob just as well at home?"
I think we might need another minute's silence. Beautiful, sure. I must say this has been quite a difficult assignment in terms of chairing because your books are so unique. And as much as there are common themes and threads, and grief is one of them, death is another, they're their own entities. And yet, one of the themes that runs throughout is war. So with that in mind, I think, for Lusho, if you can talk about your choice as an author to reckon with the Second World War so steeped in facing death in Lagos, in Nigeria, and what that drew out.
So I really believe that writing is such a strong way to journey into grief. I don't think there's a single person on earth that hasn't experienced the pain of losing a loved one. And I mean, the Second World War is full of so much loss. I tell people that The Power Wife is not about the Second World War. It's mm-hmm. about the women who stayed behind in Lagos, Nigeria, that had to grapple with the loss and love and, you know, the resilience that they had to face in the wake of the war. And to say that writing is to journey with grief, it doesn't mean that we want to live with pain. It's learning how to carry the pain. It's learning how to carry the grief. Similar to what Remy said about, you know, grief being a language in itself. I think that when we face the death of a loved one, we're almost learning how to speak grief, how to carry that grief. And the grief really shapes us as people. So it's learning how to fill that new space that the shape has created in us. So I really wanted to pick that time in Nigeria's history because, A, I didn't know much about it, but I also imagined that there was so much, which I then found out when doing the research, there was so much loss and grief that could be unpacked into hope in the form of Kehinde's story.
Sure. And Remy, you have a short story, which is advice for military-aged men.
Yeah,
you deal with war there as well.
Yeah, conflict, especially with the masculine experience of it. About the recruitment, about the training, and then eventual immersion within, you know, the theater of war and the way masculinity is performed throughout. And the reason for that, really, at least within the context of the mixtape, is that it's the only short story or track where violence is meted out in very tangible ways that we all know. I try to concoct a set of stories in which sometimes the violence is quiet and then the other times when it's loud. But war is something that we can all at least collectively understand. We've seen documentaries, we've seen videos, we've seen all kinds of, you know, things that we are very, very familiar with when it comes to war. And I wanted to depict it to try and immerse the reader within the enactment of it in a very violent and jarring way. As in, yes, this is one primary way to experience death, or not to experience death, but to cause death. So in that song, it's not about experiencing or facing death, but about being able to enact it. And how the series of choices, when you go through enacting death, there are so many multiple exits out. And how the multiple rationales made for continuing up until the process of enacting death, its consequences are not accidental. They are choice-driven. It's deliberate. It's we're going to storm this village, hold it captive, siege. Anything that walks out, we will annihilate. You could have stayed at home and made tea, but you're here on the other side of the world, you know, doing this horrific act. So I wanted to create a narrative in which these things are not just left to the weird physics of the universe. Mm-hmm. It's human action, deliberate, considered, policy-driven. Mm-hmm. Someone has signed their name on a document somewhere that says, this is fine, and we're going to do it. And somebody's come up with a curriculum for how you kill people. Mm-hmm. And students have gone in and studied how to kill people. And now they're on the other side of the world doing their practical. You know, I wanted to make sure that the act of facing death is one thing, but I wanted, in that story, I wanted to show that this particular thing is not accidental. And so it's like the deliberate action of enacting death. Mm, yeah.
Sure. Wow. Sarah, I'm curious about the poem you wrote, which has a date on it. Mm. So can you keep it and not scoop it, since I've already scooped one of the books on this panel. But tell us about the 17th of, was it May, 2011, and how that became the hook for one of your poems.
So the 17th is the of May, spoiler alert, it's not really, it's just my life, but it was the, I was as shocked as you were. I asked my dad actually, but anyways, it was the day I moved from Libya to South Africa in 2011. And I don't know how much you guys know about Libya, but a war started there a couple of months. So it started in February and I moved in May. And I mean, yeah, that was the date that I moved, and then I wrote a poem, you know, with this title. And then the book launch 11 years later. So when I moved here, I couldn't speak English at all. And I was really disoriented. My family was, you know, disoriented. It was like not a great time. I mean, the war was, you know, difficult. Mm-hmm. Luckily, I got to leave very quickly, I guess. But yeah. And then at some point, I started writing poetry, obviously, once I learned the language. And I just titled it that, like the title came to me later. And then the book actually was launched on the same day by accident. I didn't choose the day, it was the festival that I chose the day. And my absolute favorite book I saw last week, Extracting the Stone of Madness, something I've been stuck on for years, was also launched on the same day 60 years ago or something like that, you know?
Sure.
So, I mean, that's 1/365 chance of that happening. But there are those moments like where it was full circle. It's also interesting that with certain feelings, I don't know what to do with the date, you know? So I just wrote a poem about it. I mean, maybe it means nothing. Maybe I'm happy that I got to escape the war. Maybe it's just I'm still not fine with it. So I think that's what we've been talking about, language as embodying grief and being intentionally like violent in language, like you said. I mean, the poem I read as well, it's not really an easy poem to read, and I would have never read it in front of my family. You know, and with poetry, it's a bit tricky because, you know, it's not fiction, but I suppose you can deny it. But yeah, I know. But so that's the date.
Yeah. Kismet is the word that popped into my head with the.
What is it?
Kismet.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's actually an Arabic word.
Yeah. Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Wow. Mm. Yeah. So, Fulusho, I wanted to ask you if you had to, in a little quick burst, describe the journeying with grief that happens in your novel, The Parlor Wife. How would you sum it up? This is your pitch time. Ooh. Now that we're
That is a hard question, but I will try. If I could sum it up, I would say that Candy starts the book very naively, thinking that life is something to be taken for granted. But she realizes very quickly in the book that it's not. And when you're not prepared for death, it can be very daunting. However, in the process of finding that out, her hope is reborn in the resilience it takes in surviving the death of one of her favorite people.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful.
And Remy, for you?
For you,
what is the journey of journeying with grief that your book
Within the narrative,
takes.
First, I think I'll split it into two parts. Within the narrative of the mixtape, the first thing is cataclysmic loss. I'm really interested in exploring the narratives of people going through extreme emotion, whether it is elation or, you know, death and loss. So I wanted to break it up into, and said the first part is just dealing with loss, which when it is individualized, it is the most traumatic, cataclysmic thing that anyone can go into, to lose anything, a loved one. Let's focus on the loved one. It's just the worst thing that could happen to you in that moment in time. Mm. On the geographic scale of time, it's just another small blimp, right? When you zoom out, it's not that big, but when you zoom in, it's terrible. Mm. But then after loss, after time, distance from that incident in which this tragic loss occurs, grief comes, and grief is more about the practice of living with that absence. And so within the writing, the grief comes after a period of understanding, a period of exploration, after a period of transformation. And then when they say grief is a language that you need to learn how to speak, it's, I guess, an affirmation that it's not something that ever goes away. Mm-hmm. It's something that's constant. Mm-hmm. And while I was writing this, I was always on the side, I was like always involved in like weird YouTube deep searches. Mm. And, you know, there's this thing that says, you know, gravity is both is the most pervasive force in the universe, but it is also the weakest. Mm-hmm. One of the weakest. I think one of the weakest. I might be corrected. But grief in a lot of ways is that. Like loss is individual and it's big. And then grief is everywhere, but it's also sometimes it's strong, sometimes it's weak. Mm. But it's this inevitable thing of our human universes. We're all going to lose, sooner or later, inevitably. Mm-hmm. But the grief process that comes afterwards is so different for everybody. Mm. Some people are consumed and destroyed, like you know, like the death of fading stars. And some people, despite their loss, are able to transform and become better. Not even better, just different in, I guess, better ways. And so for me, within this book, it was an attempt to deal with the loss first, break it in two phases, loss, and then try and explore how that language of grief manifests itself with the people who are affected by this thing. Yeah. And I wanted to like make it look like a black hole. So like within the literature, you can't tell how big the loss is. But then through the narrative, you can sometimes tell how big a house is by the perimeter of the walls.
Yes.
And you know, you're still going around and be like, how big is this house? And I've been driving around Cape Town, and you see some walls that go on for miles. I'm like, how big is this house? and so that's what I'm trying to achieve in the literature, because I don't think anyone can understand what loss is to the individualized person. It's like trying to go through or see through a black hole, which is impossible. But you can tell the size and magnitude of the loss by the people who are affected by this human condition. Mm. Yeah.
Yes. It's so interesting. There's a kind of celestial element to this conversation, because you spoke about the impending doom of the sun dying, and you've spoken about black holes.
Soon, by the way, really soon. Like, I was really, because I knew I would go.
Yeah.
But I just thought the world would stay, you know. But anyway. Yeah. Yeah, but that's
So I had one fun question where I was like, how are we going to lift ourselves out of the dregs here? And that was kind of, you know, when someone says, oh, good grief, you know, and I just wondered, you know, what was the grief in the writing process? Mm. Like, what was something where you were just kind of like, oh, this copy editor is just driving me up the ruddy bend, or I just can't get this line in the poem, or I'm looking for a piece of research that I knew I saw 6 months ago from that diary of that amazing woman, and now it's gone, and it's from 1937 or whatever. So just in a tidbit, because then we're going to open up to the floor.
Yeah.
What was a moment of good grief for you as writers, subjectively, in producing your manuscripts?
Sorry, repeat the question a little more.
Yes. So what was a moment of grief that you as the writer experienced in this process. And I'm being quite glib and flippant about it, but it might have been a very deep and painful thing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you had a story that you've been working on and you lost it, or it just wasn't coming right and you had to park it, or that kind of thing. Should we start on the left here?
Yeah, so
I'm getting knowing nods from you. So
I have a moment that I guess I'll bring forward, but the hardest part for me in writing The Palo Wife was trying to make it historically accurate without making it read like a history textbook. And I remember when I submitted the first draft to my agents, and there was just so much red everywhere, and I remember there was one comment that stood out, and it was, "This part reads like a guidebook." And I was like, oh gosh. A guidebook, like a history guidebook. I was just like, oh gosh. So that was the hardest part for me in writing The Palo Wife. And I think how I was able to kind of overcome that challenge was focusing on the human experience. So what was each character feeling at this time? And then having the research be kind of not the scaffolding, but the paint after, like just making sure it was accurate and it made sense, but it wasn't the core of the story. The core of the story are my characters and what they were feeling as they journeyed through the book.
Beautiful.
Sarah? I've got two. One is serious, one is not. So
okay, great.
My mentor, Sally Ann Murray, like she's the most incredible woman, and she's seen me through years. It's also quite a rigorous academic and writer. And so, of course, I would share pieces with her, you know, and she would just say it straight. So she's like, "Sarah, stop dilly-dallying, get to," or she's like, "When you work, you know," so she's like, "When you work, you know," but, you know, things like that. So like working with these incredible women, my publisher as well, she doesn't mess around. So if it's bad, she tells you. And if it's average, she also tells you. But yeah, so that was like more the process. And it's also a little bit silly, like ridiculous. And it's obscure to like say, "I'm a poet." Like, what the hell do you mean? You know? But okay, I've got Facing Death on Sunday. You know? There's like a meme format where it's always like cooks be like, or like chefs be like, "I've got muffins due at 12 or whatever." And like poets, like yesterday was tensions at home. Today it's facing death. What? Wow. You know? So anyways, those are the kind of funny moments. The slightly more the grief, like of the process of writing, is of course sometimes it used to be self-destructive almost to expose myself on the page and to think, screw this, I'm going to just absolutely, you know, the book opens with a Libyan proverb and it's in the house of someone who has been hanged, do not speak of rope, like stop bringing up all of this. Every single rope I've ever seen, I put into this book. So it's sometimes I had to deal with myself being like, are you writing for the right reasons? Are you just destroying everything? And also, you know, kind of like the linguistic and artistic part of writing and the craft and like studying it and, you know, versus the text, it's the emotions themselves. And I think that's why the poetry was not ready. I mean, I've been sitting with these poems for a decade, basically, but I needed to learn, and that's the beautiful thing about writing. You learn it, you know, it's not... Yeah, I needed to learn how to balance craft with what's inside, because if it spills all over, you're just, like, indulging yourself and you know, nobody... But then form, for the sake of form, is also... Yeah, and I don't know form. I never learned. I don't know where I was. I studied English. I don't know what a sonnet is, you know. But so I had to figure out what form is to me and to, like, practice that line of, okay, this is also a piece, like, of text. It's not really about you in a way. And everyone will relate to it. Like, you guys wouldn't care if all the poems just happened to me. Like, the reason we read is, and that's why I read, is because you can see yourself, you know. Yeah. So anyways, it was just that, like, figuring out... how to, you know, because on the other hand, it's like, well, I escaped the war or I experienced a horrible thing. Why should I care what the freaking the third draft, the spacing, double spacing? Why should I care? You know, but I do care. That's it.
I find it beautiful that you say that you learn it by doing, because that's, to me, strikes me as true of grief as well. You learn it through the experiential. You have to kind of muck in. Yeah. Remy?
I can be honest and say that I had a very good time writing these very sad, sad stories.
That's worrying because, as well.
because writing, at least the type of writing I aspire to do is art making. And when you're an artist and you're writing and you're dedicated to your craft and you really try your best, you are sent to this magical state of zen or flow where you're like wrangling sentences. You don't even know where the hell they come from and you put them on the page. And so in that state of transcendence, you're really saved from like things about like the loss of the things that you're writing about, which are not always necessarily mine. So even when something's bad is happening to a character, I laugh because I'm like, I'm playing God here. and I can't say that I had a tough time writing in terms of like getting the language, yes, but I don't think I cried on the page or cried through a paragraph because again, I'm in this state of transcendence where I am not myself and these concerns within the story are not mine. They are character concerns, but they are not personal concerns. And I like that state of creation, and the desire for me for writing is to get as close to that state again. When it comes to the editing, there's also no grief because this is something that I've aspired to do since I was young. And so when an editor sends me corrections, it's like, yeah, but you wanted to do this. So bitching about this is pointless. What I do aspire to do and what challenges me is to get it back with fewer track changes, right? I remember the first time I ever wrote an English essay. Again, this was not my native language. It came back all red. And I was just like, yo, the next one must have fewer red lines. Whoa. And so I feel like that about my writing where I really try to expend a lot of energy in it because I know the editing is going to happen. But I've also looked forward to this very tough part of the writing phase. Because when you're writing in phase, it's isolation. It's just you and your voices in your head. But when editing is someone else. But what I found with editing is like being in a very good dance. You're with someone else. And if they're a good leader, you sort of trust. And they're like, I see you want to go here. They show you like multiple ways of getting to the same place. And for me, writing is already hard enough and it's already dangerous enough to be part of this literary exercise. So editing, the writing part, I try to approach it from a, this is a gift. This is something a lot of people are not allowed to participate in. So I don't have any negative aspects with the writing or the editing. Publishing is a whole separate thing because that's someone else trying to get a risk on you. But yeah, that's where fears come out. I'm like, will this thing that we've done for a very long time reach the light of day? And that's when like you confront market forces and things like that. But writing and revisiting your work, those for me, I take as a luxury. Like, and you're allowed to do this over and over again. And so I don't think I have any sad stories.
How lovely. An antidote to grief, writing. It's interesting because you talk about luxuriate, and that reminds me of a very like luxurious and sort of opulent poem in your book. But we are now opening the floor to questions. We have a whole 10 minutes, and we've got a hand up right over there. So let's get to it. And if anyone's feeling inspired to share what came up for them between the meditation at the start and the discussion, please feel free.
Thank you so much. Thank you for sharing your work. It was very, very moving. My question kind of builds on what you mentioned in one of your stories, Remy, where you talked about one story looked at how death is used as a tool, how it's taught, how it becomes practice. And considering this thorough line of war, what I was thinking about is how death has been institutionalized. And certain people are in closer proximity to death, right, in various ways, at various levels of society. And creating that proximity to death as a tool of, you know, one would argue psychological, spiritual terror, torture, torment. My question is, do you feel like that has changed grief, the way that people can grieve, whether they can grieve at all, since death is all around us all the time, never ending. Thank you.
I don't think it has. So I think the prevalence of like death within, let's say, common media sort of trivializes the loss of the people who are suffering and undergoing this process. But death has always been around. It is not new at all. And yes, it has been used as psychological torture and, you know, degrading the human soul by showing dead bodies and dead bodies and bodies. It's tarnishing or depreciating the value of this thing that should be sacred and, I guess, in private in a lot of ways. So that has happened. But death is not anything new. And I think the people who are undergoing that process are still facing it at a very deep and profound level. However, what I do think is that when we talk about the language of grief, we are naive in a lot of ways, thinking that it's only death we can grieve. I've back in Cape Town, and I've been aching for the city since I fucking left in 2012, because Cape Town was the city of my youth, where I thought, this is where my life is gonna be, this, that, and the other. I knew this like the back of my hand. And being back here is sort of like, not painful, but it's like an ache. And you can miss a place in the same way that you can miss a person. Like you can miss your dog that died or that song that makes you think of that. And so the language of grief is not just for loved one, but I think it's for loved things that have a consequence or an effect on your identity. So when I moved from Cape Town, I lost that thing that I thought was part of my identity. And I still grieve for this place in like weird ways. Like it only takes one bad interaction for me in Vintage to be like,
come back to Cape Town.
This would not be happening there. So,
yeah.
So it's not just the language of grief is not just for loved ones we've lost, but I think it's for loved things, and that could be a place, a person, or anything that's been taken out of your life. Yeah, yourself. Yeah. Oh my God. People lose jobs, and they have to learn the language of grieving those jobs. In Namibia, we grieve every year because we're in a land of perpetual drought. And so we miss the rain in very intimate ways that other places where it rains every day, they do not. Like I sometimes envy Cape Townians and how much they hate winter. You know, because it rains here regularly and it's miserable. In Nam, we're just like, water.
Yeah. Oh my God.
Yeah. Before someone else grieves not getting to ask their question at this panel, any other hands? We've got one over here and one over here. Where's the mic? Oh, you've got it. Go for it.
Hi. Thank you so much, all of you, for sharing. It was a really fantastic panel. Coming back to Remy, the quote that you read, I'm thinking about sharing in other people's grief, showing up for other people when they're grieving. For everyone, has writing about grief and confronting grief in your work changed or affected how you show up for other people who are grieving?
Hot take, because we've got one more question after that. Go for it.
Felicia first.
Each of you. Boom, boom, boom. Quickly.
I have not become a better person or a kinder person through the aspect of writing about grief. But I have become a better and different person through being around people who have suffered this thing.
Yes.
So I'm not one of those people who say writing is therapy. Mm-hmm. Writing is therapeutic in the same way that a massage might be or a good walk might be, but the physical act of dealing with trauma and loss and grief, that is a complex thing that cannot be undone by an individual with a pen.
And time.
And time.
Whether writing about grief has
made you more empathetic.
No, but what I was thinking about, learning the language of grief, that would be an active act, you know, and that, you know, you can kind of, and then you're right, it's not always fun, writing is not always fun, but I must say in the last couple of years, I've like been really thinking about writing as play, so it's definitely not a therapy, but you get to have fun with it, even as you said, even if you're writing about difficult things, okay, you can, but you can also escape onto it. And so with prose especially, I'm like, oh, I'm going to say silly things, or I'm going to make this woman, you know, whatever, it's my space.
We're on the clock.
Yeah, very quickly, I think the answer for me would be yes and no. So yes, because reflecting on what grief could look like in different shapes and forms makes me more empathetic when I meet a new shape or form of grief. No, because grief is not something that's factual. There's no list of the five things that every human being experiences when they're grieving. Yeah. It's nebulous, it's irrational, it changes every time. Mm. And I think it would be impudent of me to assume that because I write about grief, I'm empathetic to every kind of grief.
Yeah.
Sure, such modest, wise, self-effacing writers. Last question, and we'll do rapid-fire answers again. I'm sorry to have to do this to you.
No worries.
Grieve the longer answers you would have liked to have given if we weren't so constrained. Where's the last question? Over there.
Hi. Can you hear me? Thanks for the panel. It's very good. Just want to say I am an astrophysicist, so I appreciate Sarah's shared concern with the death of the sun. Keeps me up every night.
Why didn't you tell me?
But my question is for all three of you. I think something maybe left unsaid in this panel was a discussion of grief in terms of revenge when the death is done to you. So someone has taken a member of your family from you actively, as opposed to an accident or something from a larger context. Just wondered if any of your works, what do you think about that, or personally?
Within the context of the story, people are taken from people. Yeah. But the final message is that, not a final message, but a message is that surviving is winning. And it doesn't. You can never completely satisfy that desire for vengeance, but eventually you might, with work and with grace and dignity, reach a stage where surviving is winning.
Sure, yeah. Beautiful.
Me? I will leave you guys with an Albert Camus quote, which is, "Should I make a cup of coffee or should I kill myself?" That's exactly what it feels like. I think. By the time we learn that, it's unfortunately a bit darker than your thing, but by the time we learn the language of grief and we see the tempo of it, we kind of die, you know? So you got to savor this right now as you're learning the language of grief, but you're not prepping for anything else or more. It's just, this is it, and that's absolutely fucking stunning, you know? So, well,
So very quickly, my answer to that would be, I think of grief as an endurance sport, almost. It's, you know, like when you're running a marathon, the different feelings you feel at different kilometers. And initially, there is the anger. That's the beginning. You want to pin this pain on somebody or something that has caused the pain. But as time goes on, you learn to carry the grief in a way that helps you run the course of your life.
Okay, and on that note, thank you all for facing death on your Sunday morning at the Open Book Festival. Thank you to the amazing panelists.
Thank you, Erin. That was a beautiful interview. Thank you.
Thank you.
And of course, these fabulous authors' amazing books are on sale in the marketplace downstairs. Yeah. So be sure to whip out those wallets. I just heard one now, ripping open. And genuinely, each book incredibly different, beautiful, worth taking and reckoning with. And all aboard and now off the caravan of journeying with grief. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. This event was made possible by the support of the City of Cape Town, the Heinrich Bull Foundation, and the Wheatfield Estate Foundation Trust.